Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts. WSECU's goal is to help make the right card make a difference. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
So, brothers. They're the best, right?
Don't touch me with it! Don't touch me with it!
It's my book! There you do! And give me it! It's my library book!
I said, don't talk to me!
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and these are my two loving sons.
My name is Ezra Spitzer. I'm 10 years old.
I am Oliver Spitzer.
And how old are you?
I am 8 years old, 8 and a half.
What's one of the worst things about being a little brother?
Well, your older brother isn't always nice to you. Let's just say that. Like taunting you, stealing your stuff.
You get beat up on a lot.
You get beat up on even though you're the bigger one?
Because the younger brother, he's a different way of seeing things. He thinks more things are punishable by pain.
He, laughs at me, and that really triggers me.
And so how do you get him back when he does that?
Kicking him. I'm being serious.
I know you are. These fights are often over such life and death matters as who gets the broken cookie, or getting into the car.
Well, basically, either me or Ezra gets into the seat closer to the door.
Yeah, sometimes when we get into the car, he doesn't want to, like, get in on the other side, so.
And it's in the morning, so the other one's too lazy to go over to the other side and climbs over the person's legs.
Walks on my legs.
So then that causes the person who got in first to get mad at the person who didn't get in first.
I must admit, sometimes I engage physically. I understand it's bad, but I go into fight or flight mode.
And so on.
Of course, and you saw this coming, there are moments of tolerance, patience, and even occasional empathy, especially in times of crisis.
Can I tell them about what happened at the pogo accident?
The day before, I had this huge test.
So I'm on my pogo stick. I was getting really, really good at it.
My brother pogo sticked into a glass window.
I got too close to this window pane and my butt went through it. And a piece of glass went into my butt.
And I had to get stitches. And I really wanted to come with him.
Yeah.
But he told me to just stay back and get my rest so I'd do well on the test.
It was bloody.
Very.
And so I took his advice, and I did really well on the test.
How come you wanted to come?
Well, I wanted to care for my older brother.
How do you think your, like, relationship will change over the years, or will it?
Maybe I think we'll become even more close. We'll become good friends.
What percentage of the time would you say you guys get along fine?
Maybe 38%.
So you think there's more often that you're not getting along than you are?
Yes. But I have a feeling that over the years it's going to change to more like 87%.
Why?
Well, I just think our relationship will improve.
Today on the show, our theme is My Brother's Keeper, stories of taking care of one another, whether it's a biological brother or someone you just find kinship to. That's all ahead on Sound Effect. If you have siblings, you know how the age-related pecking order can seem so important when you're little? Whether you're older or younger, the birth order can define your role in the family. But then you grow up, and the roles get a lot mushier. Little siblings can protect, older sibs can need a hand. This is kind of a recurring theme in our stories today, and it's a big one for Sasha M. Sasha's a photographer and a web strategist in Seattle, and she came in to tell us about her older brother, Thomas.
So oftentimes I would see him come home from school looking exhausted. He would drop his backpack onto the floor, get into bed, and just sleep and sleep and sleep. And oftentimes we would be alone because my mother was a doctor and she was doing her residency at a hospital, often spending nights at the hospital. So he and I would be alone and I would wake him up for dinner. I'd often have to shake him and call him. I would say, "Oppa, oppa," which is Korean for big brother. And he would wake up and we'd sit across from the dinner table and he would be silent as we ate. And oftentimes after we'd eat, he'd watch some TV. But a lot of times he would just go back to bed. And when he wasn't sleeping, he was often kind of angry and kind of violent. One time, he got really angry because my breath smelled like peanut butter. And he got really angry. He was like, "Your breath stinks. You know, why didn't you brush your teeth?" And he was just shouting and getting really angry. And then he just took my head and slammed it against the drawer and I ended up with a black eye. And, you know, both of us were really upset by this. He was remorseful right away. And there were a couple of other occasions when things like this happened. I have a lot of sweet memories about my brother. He always took care of me. Like he would walk me to school, he would walk me back. He would help me do homework sometimes. He taught me how to ride a bicycle. That's one of the sweetest memories that I have. One summer I was just riding this bicycle with training wheels and then he unscrewed the training wheels one day and he said, "You're ready." And I was like, "Really?" And he's like, "Yeah." So I got on the bicycle and he said, "Here, I'll hold you, but just keep pedaling." And so I started pedaling and his hand was on my back as I was pedaling. And he said, "Keep going faster, faster, faster." And so I pedaled faster and I felt this rush when I felt this hand lift away from my back and I realized that I was riding the bicycle on my own. And I could hear him behind me cheering me on saying, "Woohoo, you know, you're doing it, you're doing it, woohoo." So, you know, that's one of my sweetest memories. And I always thought of him as kind of a protector and just always a big brother figure. You know, many years later, I moved to Seattle, and at some point, he's picked up by the police. He was driving around, and I think he might have run out of gas or something, and he was disoriented. The police picked him up and sent him to a mental hospital. I actually went to visit him at the hospital. And, you know, he was in a hospital gown and he was given a lot of drugs. I think at the time he was diagnosed for bipolar disorder. And so for the first time, we had a name for his condition. It wasn't just that he was angry and he was sleeping a lot. It was he was bipolar. He got up out of bed to see me, but he was just visibly really exhausted. And he had this plastic bracelet around his wrist. And he just kept playing around with that bracelet and he just looked at me and was slurring his words and he just said, "I can't take this off." And I think it just dawned on me at that time that there was this huge gap between our lives. You know, because by that point I had graduated from college. I had lived in Europe. It just seemed really unfathomable how we had come from the same family. Like, how could I have so much and him so little? There was such a gap between the haves and the have-nots in one family. And if there's any kind of blessing about his illness, it's that
You know, he's always reminding me of how good I have it. Anytime I feel lonely or sad about my own life, I think about my brother and I think about how much tougher he must have it and how he's so strong to keep on living.
There was one time when, you know, he was in New York. I was visiting him and my mother, and he'd gone to Macy's one day and spent $700 on jewelry for a woman that he hadn't seen in like over 15 years or so. It was this woman that he had a crush on in high school. Her name was Deborah. And he was convinced that Deborah would marry him. And he tracked her phone number and left 7 or 8 different messages. And when she finally called, I was actually the person answering the call. And Deborah was really confused. Deborah was a lawyer by then, and she thought that my brother's calls were about a case that she was working on. And I told her, no, you know, my brother was a classmate of yours in high school. And she said, really? Thomas? Thomas M? I don't remember that. I don't remember a Thomas M. That night when my brother came home, what I did say was, you need to take your medication. And I took him to the bathroom where all of his medicine bottles were lined up. You know, they'd been untouched. And he said, no, I don't. I said, yes, you do. And he said, well, the doctor says it's up to me. And he got really angry. And I just said, I will take them with you. Okay, I'll just take them with you. Because I was so desperate for him to start taking his medication. And he said, okay. So I was about to take one of the pills, but as soon as I put one into my mouth, he said, wait. And I said, what? He said, let me cut these in half for you because you're smaller than me. These might be too much for you. And so I gave him back the pills and he took them to a cutting board. And he started cutting each pill so carefully, like he was crouched over them so methodically. I thought, oh my gosh, like even in this thick delusional haze, my brother still cares about me. He's still my big brother. He still wants to take care of me. We visit each other at least once or twice a year. Last summer, he came to visit me in Seattle, and I was really nervous about that trip because it was going to be a one-week trip, and he had recently suffered a mental breakdown, so I didn't know how he was going to be. We had a really good week. Towards the end of that week, he saw a flyer for an 80s night at a club. And he really wanted to go to that. And I said, oh, God, no, I don't want to go to an 80s night. And we're going to look like boyfriend and girlfriend. And he said, oh, come on, it'll be a lot of fun. So, you know, we got dressed up and went to the club. And my brother just, you know, went right into the middle of the dance floor and started dancing and smiling at people. And he's having a good time. And he beckons me to come to the dance floor. And I thought, oh, gosh, I really don't want to do this. But then I think, when else am I going to have this opportunity to dance with my brother? So I go onto the middle of the dance floor and, you know, like the Eurythmics Sweet Dreams comes on. Sweet dreams are made of this. And my brother's singing along and having such a great time. And we're dancing together and, you know, we don't just look like boyfriend and girlfriend. We actually look like an old married couple out on a date night without the kids. And we're holding hands and just having a great time. So, you know, we keep dancing that night. And I think, gosh, like, I really don't know him. You know, for a long time, I've just seen him as someone who's mentally ill and someone to feel sorry for. Someone who suffers more than me, but I, you know, really just like need to you know, learn more about him as another person, as a friend and another human being, and try to create these moments of joy like the dancing with him. Before, I think I was really trying to fix his problems. And we would argue a lot about his illness. At this point in our lives, I've come to realize that just trying to accept him for who he is and for some of the joy and heartbreak that he brings to my life, like just embracing all of that, would be the best thing to do. I think whatever is happening with another person, we were there like at the source. Like we were there to somehow shape this person. And so, you know, we're very much a part of this disease as well.
Sasha M. lives in Seattle. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is My Brother's Keeper. Most of us have 46 chromosomes in our cells, those little wormy packages of DNA that contain all our genetic information. But some people have an extra, a 47th chromosome, which causes a condition called Down syndrome. Down syndrome affects nearly every part of the body, and so people who have it have some special needs, including their medical care. There's only one clinic in the Northwest focused on the unique medical needs of children with Down syndrome. It's in Issaquah, and kids from as far as Spokane come to get all of their routine care in one place without having to go to a bunch of other places to see different specialists. Caring for people with Down syndrome and their families is Dr. Rebecca Partridge's mission. She started this clinic with Virginia Mason Hospital 6 years ago. She knows Down syndrome inside and out, through experiences both professional and personal. The day I visit, she heads into an exam room to meet Michelle and Chris Peterson and their crazy adorable 18-month-old boy, Jack.
He loves patting his head, and it's the vocabulary for silly. Huh, buddy? Daddy's silly. Yeah, oh man, daddy's, oh, Jack is silly.
Well, should we get started?
Yeah.
Fantastic, it's okay if I slip right in here, and I'm gonna shut the door.
Wonderful.
Well, even though it's only been 3 months, I feel like I haven't seen you forever.
I don't know.
It's been a big 3 months.
Yes,
this last month.
Partridge is thrilled to hear about some of Jack's progress.
The fact that he's walking is actually really remarkable. I think we've talked about the fact that most children with Down syndrome don't walk until an average of 23 months. So Jack's ahead of the curve there.
As Jack happily goes through the hand motions of Itsy Bitsy Spider over and over again, Partridge asks Michelle and Chris a series of questions.
Tell me what kind of sounds you're hearing from him.
Still mostly dada and hi. He started, we think he said mom or the M's, and he's starting to, his vocabulary is getting a little bigger.
Any neck concerns? Does he have good range of motion of his neck? Looks up, down, side to side?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think everything's good there.
Partridge tells them that kids with Down syndrome often have instability in the neck, meaning that Jack shouldn't play football or head the ball in soccer. Now, Chris is an avid soccer player, and he blanches a little bit when he first hears that. You can sort of see him mentally recalculating as he and Michelle calibrate their expectations about life as a family. Seeing that reaction, Dr. Partridge makes clear that Jack can still play soccer, and in any case, the parents are the bosses.
So I feel like my job is to be your consultant. I get to give you the information, and you, as the parents, get to make the decisions.
During checkups, Partridge refers to her patients as our children. She has a son with Down syndrome. He's 17 years old. Rebecca Partridge and I huddle up in her office between appointments, and she tells me about her son and how this clinic came to be. But first, she shares a kind of surprising story from her own childhood. It's about the first person with Down syndrome that she ever met at church.
And as a child, I actually was afraid of her because she was pretty big and I had a hard time understanding what she was saying, and I was scared I wouldn't know what to say if she said anything to me. And so I watched my parents interact with her, but I also was a little bit intimidated.
Time passed. Dr. Partridge grew up and pursued her dream of becoming a pediatrician. She was pregnant during her final year of medical school, and one day she got a call from her OBGYN with some test results. The child she was carrying had Down syndrome.
I immediately started sobbing and became hysterical and had to have my husband come and pick me up. I considered in that moment that the life I had built and all of the dreams that I had were over. Everything was going exactly according to plan, and this completely derailed all of it. I found a way to tell family and friends. I actually wrote a letter, and that way I could tell people how I wanted them to respond, because I did find that one of the most painful things would be when people would say, "I'm sorry." A turning point for me was when my former pediatrician had a daughter with Down syndrome, and he had me come to his office, and he just sat with me for an hour, and we talked about what it was like, both as a parent, both as a doctor, to have a child with Down syndrome, and to have someone in the room with me who understood what I was feeling was really incredible and was life-changing for me. So at his birth, I remember when I saw his face for the first time, what my first words to my son were, "I can't believe I was scared of you." Because he was just this perfect little baby. He was exactly what I had hoped for. He was a perfect little baby that I loved.
Are you okay sharing his name, his first name?
Yeah, Joshua, yes.
My brother's name.
Oh, it's a great name. It fits him. He's definitely a Joshua.
What color is his hair and all that kind of stuff?
Oh, he has very coarse, very thick brown hair that grows far too fast. And he has blue eyes.
Can you tell me a little more about his personality?
He is really fantastic at figuring things out. He managed to get onto a pizza shop online, and he created an account, and he ordered $353 worth of pizza for payable upon delivery by check. And this all happened without my knowledge. So 98% of me was incredibly angry, and 2% of me was so incredibly proud of how resourceful he was to have figured out how to do that. I didn't want to reinforce the behavior, but of course I was like in my mind high-fiving him and just saying, "Way to go, dude. I am so proud of you for figuring that out. If you do it again, you're going to be chained into your bedroom."
Did the pizza show up?
It did.
How much? I'm trying to picture $350 worth of pizza.
Well, it was 17 pizzas, 10 orders of breadsticks, 6 2-liters, and one giant cookie.
When did it occur to you that things could be better than they are in terms of care and support systems for families with a Down syndrome child?
So the onus was really on me to facilitate my son getting all of the care and services that he needed. There are so many specific things to Down syndrome. You know, for instance, adults with Down syndrome almost always talk to themselves out loud, unless they don't use words to communicate, but basically over 80% of them do. Adult providers who don't know that will see it as psychosis and put patients with Down syndrome on antipsychotics, when in reality, this is a developmentally appropriate thing that you can't change even if you want to. So recognizing what's normal in Down syndrome and what's not normal in Down syndrome is really critical.
Wow, that seems like a major one. Are there others?
There absolutely are. You know, recognizing that over 75% of people with Down syndrome can have hearing problems. Over 50% can have problems with their eyes. People with Down syndrome are more prone to autoimmune disease. These are all things that if we don't look for them, people with Down syndrome are likely not going to tell us with their words. And if we don't look, we're not going to find it. And as I alluded, there are some health benefits to having Down syndrome.
What are some of those?
So people with Down syndrome don't get coronary artery disease like you and I do. People with Down syndrome as adults also very rarely get solid tumors. Some of the most recent literature indicates that you would have to do more than 35,000 mammograms to save one life of someone with Down syndrome. Whereas I don't have Down syndrome, I have a 1 in 8 lifetime risk of developing breast cancer.
Wow. I've never heard that. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. So the two of the biggest sort of killers of Americans, they have very, very low incidence of.
Exactly.
Tell me about some of the conversations you've had with parents.
I feel like 80 to 90% of what I do in the office is just talking parent to parent. I understand how tired they are, and I understand how lucky they are, both at the same time. And that when I look at their child, I don't look at a broken person. I look at a complete person who's wonderful and perfect, just exactly how they are. Parents, we don't get that very often. Often in the community, even at school, with therapists, people look at our child because there's something wrong. And I'm looking at their child saying, you are wonderful. How can I help you be more healthy?
How do parents react when they see you do that?
Most parents cry, which is understandable. Sometimes I cry too.
Partridge says families of kids with Down syndrome rarely encounter one another, so building community is crucial. She says connections are made at this clinic all the time.
So I was seeing a 10-year-old with Down syndrome for the first time, and she had to go to the bathroom, and it was an emergency. So as I was walking her to the bathroom, she spied another little girl with Down syndrome who was 6, and she was sitting in the waiting room. And she instantly yelled, "She has my face!" And she ran over and she got down on her level and she said, "You have my face." And she asked her name, and their names both ended, began with an H. So she said, "We are the H girls. We are the same. We have the same face." And for someone with Down syndrome to be able to recognize, to see someone who looks like them, we all need that.
What was it like for you to watch that girl make that recognition?
Oh, I burst into tears in that moment, even as the physician. And they both just stared at each other and touched hands, and they both were smiling. And they both looked like they were meeting their hero.
Dr. Rebecca Partridge says she hopes to grow her pediatric clinic to include care for adults with Down syndrome. That way, her patients can continue getting their care in one place and have the chance to meet even more of their heroes. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme this week is My Brother's Keeper. Israel Joyner grew up in a family of 5 boys. And if you want to know what that's like, Israel says, just think of a herd of crazed cats.
Imagine they zoom down the hallway, clawing every single wall with colored pencil, holes, whatever they can do. That was my house.
Needless to say, there's a real survival of the fittest thing going on there, and toughness was rewarded.
The only way we would, like, fight back at each other is physically. So, like, every once in a while, someone would be, like, playing around, punching at each other, and then a full-on table gets thrown across the room. I actually have a few scars. One of the most memorable ones is because my brother was swinging around a boombox, and it hit me on the lip.
Israel is the youngest of this brood, a sophomore in high school, but not long ago he found something, a notebook from his big brother Mars, written when Mars was in 8th grade. Mars is 5 years older than Israel. Reading it and learning about his brother's old insecurities gave Israel a rare opportunity to be the big brother for a change. Israel wrote a poem about that experience, which got published in a collection of student poetry. What struck him in the notebook, he says, was the obvious gap between the imaginative writing on the page and the often harsh way that Mars would talk about himself.
There was a lot of occasions where he would talk about how he didn't dream anymore. A lot of my brothers had really low self-esteem, and I was kind of used to it by then. And I kind of wrote this poem in a way for him to branch out and do what he wants.
I asked Israel to read from his poem.
The name of the poem is He Called Himself Uncreative. He called himself uncreative, unsuccessful, and altogether horrible. Every day he long nights of fixing mistakes and doing homework for the classes he would never show up to, fist pounding and breaking walls, mind-splitting headaches, uneventful whispers for loss of time. But somewhere deep down inside his broken heart, full of broken doors and families torn apart, he screams for help. His beauty still fades into a solemn kill or be killed face. But how? How can this be when his notebook shows signatures lining up pages on pages as if he waited for the day he would sign them off to the ones who adored him? How can this be when he wrote essays about... How can he be so empty when he fears to lose the ones closest to him? Now, on this day, I swear on my life he cannot tell me he is empty, because the voices that scream out from him are so alive and so beautiful, and gives me, at least, a true definition of hope. Not the hope you find... I want him to look me in the eyes and say he can't dream again, because his hands told stories of beautiful dreams. The doodles jumping out of pages as if comic books, the stories about me, you, and Dad all together. Who you are is creative. And deep down one day the voices will break. You decide where your life falls, so take the wheel and head there. To the one you love, to the place you cherish, and the bliss you missed.
Thank you so much. One of the interesting parts of this is that he's 5 years older than you, but the guy who was writing in that notebook was younger than you. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of acting like a younger brother and an older brother at the same time, it seems like.
Yeah. Everyone at home can thinks of me as the well-mannered one. I forgot what it's called. I have an old mind or something.
Old soul.
Yeah.
How has Mars reacted to this poem?
Well, classic old Mars. Doesn't really show his emotions.
And did he say anything to you about it at all?
He might have, and I might have been blocking it out with my weird selective hearing.
Was it intended for his ears, or was it really more for you?
It was probably more for me.
Israel's family is a little complicated. He and Mars share a father, he and the other three share a mother, and there have been a lot of different living configurations over the years.
All throughout our lives, me and my four brothers have been split up a lot, but whenever I've been around him the longest, especially whenever the years were hard on me, he was there.
More often than not, being there for one another, showing love, it wasn't something that the brothers demonstrated through words or affection. It was between the lines of what they did together.
Where we lived at the time, we had a field next to us. And one day I walked into the house after school and I saw my brother throwing discs across the room as fast as he can at a cardboard box.
Throwing what? I'm sorry?
CDs. Just because he could. And I was like, huh, that looks pretty fun. Since Dad's gone, I'll join you. So we were just chucking these CDs at a box. He's like, hey, Israel, you want to go outside? I was like, yeah. And then we had this CD war where we threw them at each other. It hurt, but it was really fun.
Is there part of you that wishes you guys could be a little bit more open and intimate with each other?
No. I think that would be super lame. Brothers can't do that. Not us tough bunch.
I feel you, but I can see that there's way more to you than that, though, right?
Yeah.
So do you feel like you've got a little bit of a tough front, too?
Of course I have a tough front. I feel like everyone has a tough front, to be honest.
But you've been able to share this stuff, which is...
I find that one soft, small crack through writing.
Israel Joyner is in 10th grade at West Seattle High. His poem was published in the anthology Tomorrow I Will Whisper Your Name. Mars Joyner is in his third year at Washington State University, where he's studying computer science. Thank you. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Today our theme is My Brother's Keeper. If you saw a post in your Facebook feed or Instagram that said a family with two kids needed shelter for the night, what would you do? Well, in July of 2017, this is the request that Jenny Heidemann and her husband John Heidemann decided to respond to. They said yes. At the time, Jenny and her husband were raising two young kids in a modest split-level home in Spokane. The family that needed help was a couple with their infant and young child. They were living in a broken-down car in the blazing summer heat. They'd moved to Spokane to start a new life, and they had jobs, but they also had debts, and they just couldn't get any traction. Jenny tells us how what was supposed to be a one-night stay stretched to 8 months and brought her face-to-face with sides of herself that she never realized were there. And by the way, the family that needed help is fine with Jenny telling this story, but they're still working on rebuilding their lives, and they ask that we don't use their names. They arrived on a hot summer night.
I rushed down when I heard the garage door open to help them unpack, and a couple things struck me. First of all of their possessions were in garbage bags. Just because our possessions, they're not who we are, but at the same time, there's value, and that their things were just thrown in garbage bags just felt sad. So when this family first moved in, I just wanted to be Superwoman. And I just was kind of going to show them, like, this is how you live. I looked at them, to be honest, and this is a little embarrassing to admit, but just, you obviously don't have life quite figured out because you've struggled with homelessness, and we do have life figured out. And so we're just going to show you how to do this. And so that is just the point of view in which I lived my life, and it was exhausting and frankly wrong. So when they first moved in with us, it very quickly became apparent that there were some mental health issues that they were working through, and also addictions. And the addictions weren't, I think when we hear addictions, we immediately go to drug and alcohol addictions, but addictions take many forms, and their addictions were more in the realm of shopping and video game addictions. They wouldn't spend money at, like, they wouldn't go to Target and spend a lot of money or go to the mall and spend a lot of money. The gal that lived with us especially struggled with going to the dollar store. And when you're in crisis mode, you want to find a way out. And shopping obviously releases a little bit of that dopamine. And so every single day she would go to buy something. And, you know, things are a dollar, but that mentality is what was really tripping them up. Because if you spend $100 at the dollar store, it's still $100. And so, you know, we really had to have a conversation. One, I could relate to that with her, but man, these little tiny purchases are literally keeping you from being able to have a home. And so about a month in is when we had gained enough trust from them to really allow them to be more honest about their situation. And when we started getting into that, that's when we realized if we are going to help this family get into permanent housing, and more importantly, stay in permanent housing, they're going to have to be with us for quite a while. For the first few months that they were with us, I was trying to be Superwoman and just take care of everything. However, at the same time, I was also beginning, my health was beginning to suffer. I have a suppressed immune system from a childhood illness, and I'm constantly trying to overcompensate for that. And so at first I was going 100 miles an hour, but I was also really sick. By October is when my body just was done. It just said no more. And I had a respiratory infection that turned into an infection that went into the sac around my heart and ended up going to the ER because I thought I was having a heart attack, and it turned out to be this infection. And the only cure for this was just to rest, to eat well, to sleep, and to kind of park it on the couch. And to me, that was completely humiliating because I was trying to show this family, this is how you do life, and you just push through pain. And yeah, we all have bad days, but you still get out of bed. And even when you have a headache or you're coughing, you just go. And then I had a doctor telling me, like, you can't go. I came home that next day from the hospital, and my husband had told the gal that was living with us that what had happened. And so that next day I sat on the couch and worked a little, but she did everything else. She cooked and cleaned and made our whole family dinner, and I was completely humbled by that. And it's important to share that a couple weeks before this happened, I was making dinner, and the gal came up and asked me a question that she'd asked me many times, and it was, can I do anything to help? And I answered her with the answer I always give, and that was, no, absolutely not. I don't worry about it. Just sit there. We'll just chat. I got this covered. However, this time she responded with something she had never said before, and that was, are you ever going to say yes to that question? And that stopped me in my tracks. It was at that point I realized, like, I think I'm teaching them something, but I might have a lot to learn here too. I realized that by constantly serving, constantly overtaking, really being in control of situations, it impacted her dignity. I was really keeping her down. I was also not giving her an opportunity to feel like she was a part of the team and of value. The thing that I had to learn was, one, get your pride out of the way. This is not about being superwoman. This is not about showing someone how to live their life. This is about loving people. And something that I struggled with for years is I would view people as projects. And I would befriend someone that was struggling, and I would literally think, I'll just be with them through this hard season, and then when they're fine, then I'll go on my way. This was a crash course, and people are not projects. We don't just come into someone's lives to fix them. We're with people. When you're with people, they also are gonna see the ugly parts of you. And that's something that I was trying to hide. But this family living with us for about 8 months, they saw me lose my temper with my kids. They saw my house be a disaster at times. They saw me lose my temper with my husband, get sick. They saw me also struggle with depression. And so this really taught me how to just let my guard down. My husband and I stopped looking at them as people to fix, and they stopped looking at us as their savior, essentially. And we really began to see each other as equals. My husband and I, at each of our birthdays, we tend to ask each other just simple questions, and it would be like, what is something that you want to have said you've done, or what's a goal you have for the next year? And so we were celebrating the man that lived with us. We were celebrating his birthday, and we asked him those questions, and he paused for quite a while before answering, and then said, no one's ever asked me that before. I've never thought of that. They don't even have a chance to, like, cast dreams and visions for themselves. And when they had space and time to just not be in crisis mode for a little bit, they were able to begin to dream big dreams for themselves. They were finally able to find an apartment in April. They moved out April 3rd, 2017. My husband and I, through this experience, were completely changed. It opened our eyes to the complexities of homelessness. And then for my kids, that's yet to be determined how their lives have been impacted. My kids have this really curious, funny little habit of naming hills. So every time we go up a hill, they'll name it after someone. And so there's a, my son's names are Lincoln and Hudson. And so there's a Lincoln Hill and a Hudson Hill and a Papa Hill. And we were driving over a hill one day and they go, whose hill is this? And I said, I don't know, whose hill is it? And then they named it for the one of the little boys that had been living with us. And then another hill is named after the mom that was living with us. And I realized, like, they're family members. And I guess that's also part of what we learned. Not only was our pride broken down, my pride, my compassion increased, but anyone can become family. And you just have to be willing to walk through hard, good stuff with people.
That story from Jenny Heideman in Spokane. She says she's still extremely close with the family who lived with her for 8 months. They're in contact almost every day. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Special thanks this week to Paul Currington and Ashley Gross. Sound Effect is available as a free podcast, which includes fun bonus material. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever else podcasts live. And as always, you can also tell your smart speaker to play Sound Effect the podcast. We love to get your feedback. Send it to soundeffect@knkx.org. And be sure to join us next week when our theme is Gray Area. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KN.